The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay. Welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Kaya, Miles, and Diara talking about all the news that you don't know from the last week about race and justice. All the news that should have been the most important news in the country. We talk about the NAACP Awards, Black people in tiny homes, the uncovered history of Aunt Jemima. And then we close out Black History Year with our final book club segment discussing The Sovereignty of Quiet by Kevin Quashie. Make sure to download the full reading list now at blackestbookclub.com. Also, special shout out to SiriusXM, Pandora, and Stitcher for featuring Posse of the People in New York City's Times Square. Go check us out, take a selfie, do all the things. We appreciate and love all of your support and love you for listening. The advice for this week is to watch a movie, like go see something that you wanted to see, but like didn't think you had time to see, either at home or in a theater. Make sure you're COVID safe and all those things. But I watched a couple movies this weekend and they were great. Here we go.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
I am Miles E. Johnson. You can find me doing the thing like Angela Bassett at Feral Rapture on Instagram and Twitter.
I'm Kaya Henderson on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
This is Dre at DIOL on Twitter.
This I'm really just confused by. So, you know, we are in a group chat together where we discuss a host of different things. In fact, that chat could be its own podcast. But one of the things that came up that Kaya sent through is this feedback response that's been happening around Jonathan Majors' cover of Ebony. Now, first, I just want to shout out Ebony, who the covers, the content, the writing it's been great, y'all. It's been great. I feel like it's updated, it's modernized, it's improved. So hopefully the good progress continues. And I think as part of that, this cover, which if y'all haven't seen, I mean, y'all have seen it. Jonathan Majors is the finest man on the planet. He is in pink. He's got one leg over the other. He's pursing his lips. Is that how you say that? And he's stunning, absolutely gorgeous. And so the internet, the Black internet, was upset. Some members of the Black internet community were upset and said that the photos and the shoot were another attempt to emasculate Black men. Sometimes it's our own people. You know what I'm saying? So, Miles, I want you to break this down so that I can have a framework to have which my opinion can come through.
A framework. Bring the framework.
Okay. I'm gonna work the frame. I just think that I was really impressed with Ebony. I don't know if any of my well-connected uncles and aunties on this podcast have a connect at Ebony. I would love to right there at this point, because I thought that article was such a forward-thinking, transgressive article, written in so counterculture to like where Ebony kind of positions itself as like the pillar of Black respectability and really a reinforcement in a lot of like class ideas and gender ideas. So I thought that was a really bold article when I got to read it. The other thing about it too is Jonathan Major, any single time we have this kind of fixation on a Black masculine person who has the abs and who has the deep voice, we also pin them up as the as an idol of masculinity. And of course, other races fetishize that, but also we fetishize that too. And a lot of times, Black femmes, Black women, we fetishize the hyper-masculinity just as much. And when that is broken, when that promise, that cultural unsaid promise of hyper-masculinity is broken, people get upset. Because unfortunately, I do broad strokes because I only got only split someone to talk. But unfortunately, a lot of times when we're the only one or we're one of a very few people, you have to be everything to that person. So either you're the Black dad or you're the Black hunk or you're all these different things. And when that's broken, people get really, really, really upset. And what you see to me is, and you know, I identify as a non-binary femme person. The whole gender revolution, I'm smack dab in the middle of that, you know? And what I also see is this bigger backlash to the transgender non-binary conversation and when it comes to in the Black community and in greater pop culture. And I think because we've been seeing so many Black people, so many people in general embraced defy gender stereotypes, I think that there's a little bit of a like patriarchy blues. Like, I miss when men were men. I miss when women are women, and there's this patriarchy blues. And then Jonathan Majors with his built physique and his deep voice, and he's playing, I'm not gonna front like I seen a movie that he was in, but I'm gonna assume that he's playing things that muscle men, like he boxing, yes, or baby, flying
Creed
somewhere.
Creed.
He's doing masculine things, and now that he's in a color, or now he's in a position where that's being, that fantasy is basically being disembodied, people get upset about that. People get upset in their guts about that, because they're like, we can't have that. Y'all got everything else. Y'all done did this to this person. This person's talking about this, and now we finally got Jonathan Majors, and here you are taking them. And I think that that's what it is. I would name that, yeah, patriarchy blues is what I would call it.
I love it. That's a framework. I thought this was interesting because, like, we talk so much, or I think so much about what Black freedom really is, right? Like, we are out here working every day trying to get free. And freedom means, like, you can be or do whoever you want to be and do. And so to see this actor who is right now on the top of his game, right? He's in like 3 or 4 different movies, a TV show. He's like doing all of the things, and we all Room for Everybody Black. And he's on the cover of Ebony in a super artistic thing. The other thing that was like striking to me is the stylist, Alexander Julian, drew his inspiration from an anime character. And like in a tribute to all of the Black anime fans, and felt like he was elevating a part of the community that we don't usually see. And like, you know, backlash, like, can we all get free? Can we just let people be who they want to be, however they want to be it? Why does this matter that this man is doing whatever? Ebony's statement was beautiful. They said, there's no agenda out there to emasculate Black men. If anything, there's a mission to allow them to feel liberated enough from the shackles of hegemonic masculinity, the dictation that governs how a man should act in society based on outdated rules, to embrace whatever self-expression feels best for them. I'm here for that. That's my kind of Black freedom. I'm here for mm-hmm. that.
And I just want to shout out Savannah Taylor, because I adore her, and I've been honored. My company's been honored for us to, she covered us in some of the work that we do in Tulsa. And so keep on doing your thing, Thizzle girl, because we love it. And I think the other thing, Kaya, to build off what you were saying, is that she's also, you know, she talked about Prince and the Isley Brothers and Andre 3000 and Kid. It's like, people, let people be who they want to be.
Lakeith Stansfield had a thing recently.
And I think just like what y'all were saying too, I think that a lot of the styles that happened in the 60s and 70s, we live in such a weird history moment where people, a lot of the styles that would be seen as feminine in the 70s were affiliated with pimps. and we're affiliated with things, we're either affiliated with whiteness and you were trying to be a white glam rock star, or it was pimp culture. And I think that now we live in a really interesting moment where Black people, specifically Black men or Black identified masculine people, get to dabble in things that are not as coded with either being a total race traitor or being somebody who is morally ambiguous at best, evil at worst, aka a pimp, you know? I just wanted to throw that in there too.
The only thing I'll add is that what I appreciated was that when asked, Jonathan didn't feed the hysteria. He's like, okay, loved my outfit. You know, like it was a, cause so much of this is to prod and poke him so that he will disavow the appearance, right? Like that is how this works, is that like something happens and then the person in his position is like, you know, I'm not, why everything gotta be gay? Da, 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 da. Like they do this sort of like homophobic adjacent, right? Or they like, or full blown, and he just didn't feed it. And I really loved that in addition to Ebony's statement. I loved people sort of letting the fire be the fire, but not feeding the fire. I thought that was actually really beautiful.
Jonathan Majors, know that you can come on Pod Save the People at any time and wear whatever you'd like. Thank you.
Also, you can come too. I'll send you my address and wear whatever you like too. While we're giving out invites.
So Image Award. So
Angela Bassett did the thing.
Thank Harriet Tubman for the Image Awards, because the nominations, the recognition that just does not happen in American mainstream happened at the NAACP Image Awards.
No, I loved, okay, let me not lie. I have to lead in honesty in 2023. I did not watch it, but yeah, I did watch
it. It hasn't been on TV yet. It has not been on TV yet.
Who was Gabrielle Union? What was that?
They had 4 or 5 days of events that were taped that will show on TV sometime soon, but it has not been broadcast yet. So we've just seen the coverage of it.
Got it. I'm so used to missing stuff that I just assumed. I saw them on stage talking about, well, either way, I was really excited about Gabrielle Union and Dwayne Wade. Am I saying that right? Dwayne Wade? I just feel like as soon as you enter sports, I'm not going to say your name right. But I was really excited about them advocating for LGBT rights. And I think it needs to happen. I think, you know, the next step outside of, you know, who's in their personal Black celebrity dynasty, I think that in order for it to feel like substantive to me, they should be reaching out to people who don't necessarily fulfill the, you know what I'm trying to say, child, the capitalist gain. So not your daughter, not somebody who you're doing, you know, writing with, like just regular people. I think I get attention because sometimes it feels contrived, if I'm being honest. And I think the next step for them is to do things that are outside of just people who are like, oh, I just so happen to be able to make money or be able to gain popularity or be able to expand my own stardom with that. But I love the notion of embracing other the LGBT people specifically in front of a Black audience.
Also, just going through the winners, like for supporting actor in a motion picture, Tanakh Huerta won, who he's Mexican American and he was in Black Panther. So also just love, like,
but that's what we do. That's what Black people do. We're inclusive. We call the whole family together, even though people will not call us together. Don't get me started.
That's
super,
right.
super shout out to the Best Man, the final chapters. You know, my boy is the writer director and they got lots of love at the thing. Shout out Malcolm Lee. And Morris Chestnut and Terrence Howard did the whole thing. But don't get me started. The fashions were also gorgeous.
And the A-list people came. You know, that's what because there was a moment, you know, when it was like, who's going to NAACP? It was not a, you know, it was not a thing that A-list celebrities went to anymore.
But part of that is because the establishment don't do us right, right? And so this is why it's important for us to always have our own spaces, because, you know, people like Viola Davis, who was totally snubbed in the Oscars and the Golden Globes and all of those things, shows up here as the, you know, as, you know, one of the winners for something or another. I don't know. She got her due, whatever it was. Let me see. What is it? What'd she get? Oh, Outstanding Actress in a Motion Picture, right?
But y'all, it's even like, I was watching Malcolm X. It was just on TV because TNT did like a Black History Month back to back to back. And Malcolm X was on for like 5 hours because it's so long with commercials. But you know what it got me to thinking is obviously Denzel should have won for Malcolm X, but also people like Giancarlo Esposito. So Giancarlo's been in like every Spike Lee film y'all can imagine, like, and is brilliant, right? So I think there's also highlights to your point, Kaya, all of these incredible people. And oftentimes, these actors have gone to Juilliard and Yale and all these things and got to be in comedies or things that really don't test their entire skill set, I would presume. So I think, again, it's just wonderful to have this space to be that's recognized.
That's such a good point, Diarra, because when you look at, like, somebody like Quentin Tarantino or Willie Allen, how they have like these reoccurring actors that are kind of like either seen as their muses or just like these people who are just landmarks landmarks in like in their films and you associate with them. If you're a Black director and you do the same thing, if you're John Singleton, if you're Spike Lee, then you might never be recognized for that work, even though you have like that kind of sacred relationship with director and actor and world making. But if you're world making in a Black world, then that may never be recognized. So that, I think that's why the NAACP Image Awards are, you know, important too. Did y'all see that the P-Valley, I do not know this man's name, this person's name, the person on P-Valley, and he won. I was very excited about that. And I think that's a reason, I think that, yes, I do think that sometimes Black people undervalue Black spaces, but I also think that a lot of things that are the most esteemed Black spaces were deeply conservative and deeply queerphobic. And I think that as the world and culture was changing, a lot of people were feeling that these spaces were outdated. So I think that what Gabrielle Union did and Dwayne Wade and this also the actor from P-Valley, like, winning
Nico Anon.
I think that those things show, hey, we're accepting of everybody, and this is not a space where you're going to be essentially re-traumatized in a lot of situations.
And P-Valley won Outstanding Drama Series, period.
Mm. I need to watch that.
We are so excited to continue our Blackest Book Club programming. We partnered up with Reconstruction and Campaign Zero to launch an amazing book list for our listeners. Curated by me, Kaya, Dre, and Miles, download the Pod Save the People Blackest Book Club reading list at blackestbookclub.com now. This week, we're going to talk about my book selection, one of my book selections. It's called The Sovereignty of Quiet, Beyond Resistance in Black Culture by Kevin Quashie. Okay, so I'm so excited to have shared this book. And it actually was kind of divine timing because I just read this book. So the story about how this all came about is I was in London this past December. I was there for literally 24 hours, but I had to make my way to the Howes and Worth Gallery to see Amy Sherald's exposition because she literally was like the last day that it was going to be up. This exhibition was called The World We Make, which is so interesting, Miles, and you talking about Black world making. So for those of y'all who don't know, Amy Sherald is everything. She's a portrait artist. She was the first African-American woman to complete a presidential portrait at the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery of Michelle Obama, of course. But even before that, she has this extraordinary body of work, and she describes her work as, the work reflects a desire to record life as I see it and as I feel it. My eyes search for people who are and who have the kind of light that provides the present and future with hope. So after I walked through the exhibition and saw all, you know, just experienced her work, I saw that she had a recommended book list, little table set up. And so by chance, I picked up Kevin's book. I devoured it over the holidays, and I actually keep going back to it. And then I started reading another book of his, Black Aliveness or a Poetics of Being. And y'all, this book is hitting too. Okay, first of all, let me just read you the first little something in this book. What would it mean to consider Black aliveness, especially given how readily and literally Blackness is indexed to death? To behold such aliveness, we have to imagine a Black world. We have to imagine a Black world so as to surpass that everywhere and every way of Black death, a Blackness that is understood only through such a vocabulary. This equation of Blackness and death is indisputable and enduring, surely. But if we want to try to conceptualize aliveness, we have to begin somewhere else. So he, you know, I just have been so obsessed with his poetry, but also kind of like how he's defining another space for race theory, which is through quietness, which is through poetry. And so this sovereignty of quietness is really about the quality of being inward. You know, his theory is that Blackness is so shaped by publicness. And so what he wants to do is for us to go into that inner reservoir of our thoughts, fears, and desires. So quiet, as he sees it, is a metaphor for the inner life and for a nuanced understanding of Black culture, where we understand and define our desires, our ambitions, our hungers, our vulnerabilities, and our fears. So I just wanted to bring this one because I think in the last, I guess in my lifetime, there's been a lot of loudness, a lot. And I think the way that identity for Black folks comes along is often to be in opposition to whiteness. It is to be in protest. It is to be in defiance. It is to be in resistance. And I think that does us a disservice oftentimes, because we're not able to understand how we really feel. We're not able to really express ourselves in ways that are true to our humanity. And so I just see this book as such a framework and a guiding light in terms of understanding who you are truly without the backdrop of this system. And not that we don't know, not that we don't acknowledge that system is there, but it really is an understanding of what more we can be if we go inward. And so how he does this so brilliantly is he basically compares different works. So he compares W.E.B. Du Bois with Gwendolyn Brooks. He talks about The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. And it really is the ability for Black artists in particular or culture creators to be able to give examples or, and I think this is why Amy's work is so important and so aligned and why she chose this book. It's because she just creates what she feels she needs to create. And if that isn't a canon of resistance art, if that isn't a canon of protest art, so be it. But really the true vulnerability for her is creating something that's inward to her. And so I just thought this book is actually just, it is really not just changed my perspective, but I think also given me some instruction of how I see myself and how I see my work and how I need to remember to be mindful, to be thoughtful, to go inward, to practice quietness and not kind of a passive quietness, but an active quietness in where I'm digging deeper and deeper into who I am and what that means.
This is a new one for me. This is a total, I never read this and I love it. The first thing that, as I was listening to you speaking and kind of like researching it, is that, you know, and I think I said this last week too, how everything's kind of linked together. So when I think about the work that the Knapp Ministry's doing, I cannot remember who the artist is in the moment right now, but basically it's a Black artist who did a whole a rest vessel. So it's like literally a place in the moment where you can go lay down and take a nap and rest. I think that these more performance art, social media links, ideas around rest and solitude can't be divorced from that as well. And then also the other thing that it made me reminded me of is, I don't know why I'm quoting Maya Angelou so much this episode, but it reminded me of the Maya Angelou quote where she says, It is in the interludes between being and company that we talk to ourselves. In the silence, we listen to ourselves. Then we ask questions of ourselves. We describe ourselves. And in the quietude, we may even hear the voice of God. I think that there is a way that people, and specifically Black people, how we've always known that although we're always resisting and we're always talking, we're always creating the divine noise that instructs people where to go, that is informed by our silence. We quiet ourselves enough to be able to take all the voices out and hear which is the divine voice, which is the voice that is speaking righteously. And I think that just knowing that there's more text that gives to that idea of Black people in silence and quietude is so exciting. And I'm so excited that you brought this to the podcast.
Yeah, this is super interesting to me, Diarra. Thanks for bringing it. I think the first thing that I thought was this creates, it gives us permission to retreat into ourselves and to have that introspective time that Miles just talked about, to be in conversation with ourselves. And that is not a signal that we usually get. I also felt like, you know, I have a lot of friends who are introverts and or who are shy or who don't participate in the, you know, culture of charisma, if you will. And this creates space for them. I think we so over-identify Blackness with expressiveness and sound and, you know, whatever, that if you don't show up that way, I think it's often challenging to figure out where you fit. And I think it also challenges us to think publicly about what Blackness and resistance looks like. He talks a lot about, you know, the moment in 1968 at the Mexico City Olympics, where the two athletes just raised their hand in a fist, which was a humongous protest signal, but it wasn't loud. There was no music. There was no marching. There was no whatever. It was quiet. And I think it challenges us to think about, I think it's easy for us to think about what quiet means for us as individuals, but to think about what quiet means for us as a collective and how we express outrage or joy or whatever. It challenges us to think about expression, collective expression, in a very different way. And I think I'm going to sit with that for a little while. I'm intrigued by that idea that collectively as a group, we might be able to express ourselves in this broader society in a very different way than we're accustomed to.
So that wraps up our Blackest Book Club programming. We'll have something next coming for you, but it's still available for everybody to download. So go check out the reading list at blackestbookclub.com. At the link, you can download the list and make a purchase in support of the cause. We've also designed a limited edition Blackest Book Club apparel collection featuring a range of designs and colors just for you. So thank you for those of you who have already downloaded and followed along. We are so appreciative and we hope that you got a little something out of it, or a lot. And that's it.
So my news today, I'm very excited as your resident person in everything art, culture, fashion, and theater, and now culinary. I want to let you know what's going on in the world, because I want everybody to not only live, but to thrive. And you cannot thrive without good food. So I was so excited because essentially it took me into my late 20s, early 30s until I went to restaurants that I really like just really enjoyed and really were like, oh, this is an experience. This is an artwork. Part of it was money. The other part of it is me being from Georgia, and it was like interest. So I like, there's a down home way that I think cooking is supposed to be done, that like New York City kind of broke me into another stratosphere of seeing food as like literally culinary arts. So, I believe I'm established in France. Yes, established in France. It's the Michelin rating system. The Michelin rating system, if you get a Michelin star, 1, 2, or 3, it is it basically tells you that the chef there in this restaurant is excellent. So I believe it happens in London. There's some in Dubai now. There's some in France and in New York City. But essentially, like, every pocket around the world, there should be like a Michelin star restaurant that's just scored for excellence. So the news is Charlie Mitchell, hailing from Detroit, is the first Black Michelin star chef in New York City. The first Black Michelin star chef in New York City, which sounds a little crazy.
Bananas.
As well.
Bananas.
As well, but it is what happened. And you know what? That's the news. That's what I wanted to bring in. It's pretty simple. But the other thing, as I was watching him being interviewed and I was studying more, I loved his reason for why, when, because of course people are going to say, why has this not happened before? Why did you think this not happened? And his reasoning kind of expanded how I thought about it too, which was that, you know, often Black people don't have the capacity or interest, and it's not our American dream to go through the things that you have to go through in order to be a Michelin star chef, which means the low pay, the intense work environments, that is not our idea of a dream. And he kind of, I guess, admits that it was part fascination for him and part probably in part privilege that he even had the mental capacity to even put up with what he has to put up with in order to get to this position. And I thought that was so interesting because I think that every industry has these elite pockets that you have to kind of get underpaid and sweat through in order to get it. I think the fashion industry definitely has that when it comes to who gets to be fashion editors at some of the more elite fashion magazines. I think, and who gets to be, DeRay mentioned it last week about creative directors and stuff like that. Sometimes you have to be able to already be in an economic space to put up with the underpayment and the toxic environment. And a lot of times Black people are like, I'm not doing that because I just came from that, or that's what I'm trying to avoid. That doesn't sound interesting to me, and specifically if I'm being underpaid while that's happening. But yeah, I wanted to bring this in. It's in Brooklyn Heights. The name of the restaurant is called Clover Hill. It is delicious. I want to go there for my birthday with everybody.
Oh, can we go there? Let's go there.
Okay, but you know, he got that Michelin star now, so we okay, might have to go.
To get in.
We might have to go on my 39th birthday. So how it's looking. But yeah, I want to bring this in, see what you all thought, and yeah, let's book reservations.
You know, we've talked about the Michelin rating system before, because there was a Black woman in one of the cities that I can't remember. I'm happy you brought this. It is wild in a city like New York, right? Where they have gazillion restaurants and da-da-da-da. You're like the first. I would have not been surprised if this was a different part of the country, but I was legitimately surprised in New York City. Like, it really did. That floored me. And I'm still like, wow, that we're living in a world where there are still firsts around this stuff is truly blows my mind. So I don't have more to add. I wish I was more of a foodie than I am. I'm not a big foodie, but I did appreciate celebrating him.
I'm super proud of this young man. Not only did he get a Michelin star, he also got Best Young Chef, and he's up for a James Beard Best Emerging Chef or something like that award, which is lovely when all of the official things come a knocking. But the thing that I found most interesting about this was the fact that he didn't do it the traditional way. He went to culinary school, it says, but then he was like, yeah, I need a job. I'm going to go out here in these kitchens and do the thing. And that's where he developed his, that's where he learned on the job and did his things. And I think, you know, we have always challenged the status quo. We've always done things our own way. And when we do things our own way, brilliance happens. And then later on, the establishment is like, oh yeah, that is brilliant. Here's a star. Here's an award. So I'm saying, you know, some of us are rules followers, but some of us have to break the rules in order to forge new paths. And shout out to Chef Charlie Mitchell for doing his thing.
Yeah, I was so excited to see this too. And
I mean, this actually came across my radar, Miles, because I was looking, I wanted to host an event for a client, but I wanted to do it at a Black-owned restaurant. And so this popped up to me for me, and I was excited to see it. And it just takes me to, you know, growing up in D.C., you know, there used to be a significant number of Black-owned restaurants, Black chefs. What's her name? Kyle, you remember that had the restaurant, one was in Union Station.
B. Smith.
Just
the original Martha Stewart before Martha was a Martha.
Come on.
Oh, I used to love B. Smith on TV One.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
And she had a thing in the Broadway area. She had a restaurant. Her first restaurant was on like 8th Avenue, maybe, and 40-something Street.
I guess also maybe because I was at Soul Cycle on 14th Street today in DC, I just was thinking, what is happening here? I think I'm also just in a headspace of like, where are our institutions? And even thinking about New York, like Shark Bar, and like they're just used, I just feel like there were more than there are now. And so I will spend some time digging into why that is, but I'm sure some of it's obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I was actually just texting with a friend who is a fellow foodie, and we've been exchanging Black-owned restaurants in New York and D.C. or restaurants with Black chefs. And if you have suggestions, we'll put together a list and share it amongst our folks. But I think it's really, really important. A lot of these restaurants are high-end, and we don't always support them in the ways that they need to be supported. But let us know what your favorite Black-owned or Black-chef restaurants are so that we can circulate that information and support the people in our community.
Okay. Now we starting our own Michelin star system, the
Why
Black
not?
Taste bud.
Why not?
The Black taste
Why
bud.
Not?
Okay.
Yes.
This gets
totally
too Black.
And it's like, if you had a week of opening, if you had like a week long opening where people need to come, oh my God, we'd all go. Like if it was like, if it was like the Black place you got to go to, baby, it'd be the lobby wrapped around the building. I just didn't know. I do learn so much. I mean, obviously I love the pie, but people are like, wow, you're so well read. I'm like, I just have smart friends. I mean, I do read, but every Monday I get a up to date dose of what's going on in the world.
Don't go anywhere. More Pie Take the People's coming.
My news, it kept popping up for me, and I don't know if it's because my phone is constantly listening to me and how I need a sanctuary home, like a place that, you know, where there are trees and grass and there aren't creatures running around. Well, not nasty creatures. And so what was coming up was this article about this young woman, young Black woman, 26 years old. She pays zero to live in a luxury tiny home she built for $35,000 in her backyard. First of all, the backdrop for me is I also love anything having to do with home improvement, home restoration. So I watch it all. So I think I was also just curious about like what this luxury tiny house looked like as it is a tiny house. So Precious Price, who lives in Atlanta, purchased a home, a seemingly affordable home, and wanted to rent it out. But during COVID was having a hard time renting it out, of course. And so she had another idea about this tiny home that she would build so that eventually she'd be able to rent out the bigger home and then live in the smaller home. But I think her journey around this is just fascinating because I think for so many of us who, you know, want to be homeowners, want to figure out what this process is, I think she is just such a great resource in laying out what those different options look like. And the tiny home is also interesting because she basically built it like out of her pocket, right? She didn't get a loan for that. She used her credit card. She used some savings so that she wouldn't have to owe a bank anything necessarily for when it was finished, and then rented it out and then made her money back that way. She also has a TEDx talk that I think is interesting. because it really is just really trying to figure out, like, when you are ready to build wealth, when you really, when you want to build a home, like, what are those steps that you need to take? And like, what, how can you resource yourself as much as possible to kind of start that journey? So I just found this interesting as something that we should keep top of mind, right? And I think land ownership, when it comes to Black folks, home ownership is so important and going to grow more important to us. And she also has this idea around the tiny homes when it comes to kind of land-owned communities for Black folks, which I thought was interesting as well. So just wanted to bring this because I thought it was something that just kept popping up for me. I don't know what that means psychically for me. Maybe I need to start looking into a tiny home. Kaya, can I put a tiny home in your backyard?
Which backyard is the question?
Let them know.
Michelin star flex. Oh, goodness.
So, listen, there you go.
I thought this was interesting. First of all, I am too big to live in a tiny house, but God bless the people who want to live in a tiny 200 and under 300 square feet. Child, that ain't enough time, space to change my mind. But why I thought this was interesting is because she's making a really interesting decision about lifestyle, about money, about wealth. And I think it is important, especially for younger people, to really think about what it is you need, what you want to spend your money on. You know, we've done enough pieces on the podcast about the importance of owning land and property and whatnot. And so, so I thought this was interesting too.
I thought this was really interesting as well. I think the thing that really caught my attention was what she was doing with the property. Like not just what she was doing with the property, but the reasons why. Like, I grew up in Atlanta, and knowing that most of the rentals are being used for Airbnbs now, she's really making a point to offer it to long-term residences, people who want student housing, people who want apartments that are, you know, 6 months, year long, and not just doing these kind of how Airbnb is kind of taking over certain cities that are seen as like vacation spots. I thought that was really honorable, but I will not lie that there's something a little bit apocalyptic about it, about like the necessity for it, mm-hmm. you know? So the fact that like, oh, in order for me to have a place for my parents to live, or in order for me to sustain myself, or in order for me to kind of live equitably in this world, this is the solution that I came up with, is to kind of be in this like micro living space. And listen, I love trends. I love hearing about them. I love hearing about housing trends. But I just, anytime I just like close my eyes and listen to what I call my great grandmother in the sky, which that's what I call God. Anytime I listen to that great grandmother in the sky, I know that that great grandmother in the sky does not want me to live in no tiny house, because we came up, you know, on the plantation and cleaning big houses. So I feel like the trajectory should be bigger, bigger, and bigger. And I don't like the idea of coming back down. It doesn't fit me as a bigger person. But then also just, I don't know, there's something about land and compromising and going small as a Black person that feels antithetical to my internal moral ecosystem.
This was one of those read the article, don't just look at the headline. Because when I looked at the headline, I was like, okay, tiny house, saving money. Then I was like, okay, well, you own the actual house. You own the property the house is on. You Airbnb out the original house, and now you live in the backyard. It like didn't seem as progressive as the, like the title made it. I was expecting something different. It's like, you still have a ton of capital to even be able to buy a house that you rent out every day and then build another house in the backyard. And then, so when she's like, I don't have enough closet space, I keep half the clothes in my friend's house and we swap. I'm just like, okay, this is not giving what I thought it gave, is what it is. So I was ready for I was interested because it was your news, but I was also like, come on, girl.
Y'all better leave Precious alone. I love this, first of all. And to think that sis got to a place where she can do all that. That's hard to do.
But all
it's
I'm
hard
saying,
to do.
It is hard to do. That's how come I think that God don't want us to do it if it's too hard. And you, I think that is the hint that it's not for, to be done. But also, I was thinking the same thing about, I love clothes. Like, we're literally, where I'm recording right now is literally the closet that we had to build. Well, not build, but we had to like make into a closet because I have too much stuff. But I was also thinking, like, why can't you just build a closet? Like, if you have all this, you can't just get a shed and just put your clothes in there and stuff. I was thinking about that. I was like, what?
Like a compound.
All of the choices didn't feel logical. Like, they felt a little weird. But shout out to Precious Price. Getting that down, getting that price down, preciously.
It's one of those, like, if you like it, I love it. If you like it, I love it.
I will send you. How do you Uber Eats? We can't even send her nothing from Clover Hill. We can't even give her no.
Yeah, I wonder how, like, what the address would be for that tiny house. Like, is it a letter?
Too damn small. Too damn small at the corner of go go get you an apartment avenue and rent it out that way.
Oh my God.
Well, my news is sort of funny, not funny. It's about the comic strips in these United States of America and the recent news that hundreds of newspapers across the United States have dropped the long-running comic strip Dilbert, which I think has been around for like more than 30 years or something. And Dilbert pokes fun at office culture. Well, what had happened was Scott Adams, who's the creator of Dilbert, live streamed his response on YouTube to this Rasmussen poll that asked whether people agree with the phrase, it's okay to be white. Now, this, the it's okay to be white thing is a whole thing. It was a slogan that was popularized in 2017 as a trolling campaign in extreme right circles on 4chan. And in this recent poll, 53% of Black Americans said they agreed with the statement. It's okay to be white. That sounds cool, right? Apparently not to Mr. Adams. He was taken aback by the, I guess, 47% of Black Americans who did not agree with the statement. And he went on what has only been described as a racist rant. He said Black Americans are a hate group. He said it makes no sense to help Black Americans if you're white. He also said white people should just get the hell away from them because this is a problem that can't be fixed. He blamed Black people for not focusing on education. He, he said all of the things. He, in fact, has been increasingly extremist in his views. Seems like it started when y'all's former president Trump was elected in 2016. And slowly but surely, he has done things like attacked diversity and transgender issues in his comic strip over time. In fact, he introduced a character called Dave, the Black Engineer. And slowly but surely, he's just been getting more and more radical. And this was, I guess, the straw that broke the camel's back for a lot of newspapers who have now withdrawn the comic strip from production. Many of them saying this wasn't even a hard decision. This is racist. This is against our values. Blah, 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 blah. Where y'all been for the last couple years that this dude has been getting increasingly extreme in his views? He's made a bunch of other terrible statements and whatnot. And guess who came to his defense? The only person, everybody like universally agrees that this is terrible, this is racist, blah, blah, blah. Guess who came to his defense? Of course, y'all's friend Elon Musk, the only person, tweeting over the weekend that the media is racist against white people and Asians. But I'll also use this opportunity to shout out Darren Bell. Darren Bell is the first Black artist to win a Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. If you have not seen his cartoon Canderville, check it out. He also has lots of political cartoons. And they asked Darren Bell what he thought. And he said, Scott Adams is not unique in his disgrace. His racism is not even unique among cartoonists. And he talked a lot about the growing tolerance in the United States for racist behavior. So for those of you who like the comic strips, say goodbye to your friend Dilbert and your friend Scott Adams, because as he noted on his one of his rebuttal things, he will probably have lost all of his money and his entire reputation after this, but he don't care. So neither do I.
The thing about it is, let's talk about Charlie Brown and Peanuts. Back when comic books used to be about something. But you know what, in all seriousness, what's really interesting about this to me, or the thing that kind of like, I guess, massaged my brain about this, was how embedded Dilbert and comic strips are to the American culture. It's like this kind of like ubiquitous, everywhere thing that exists, and how the people who are creating the very things that are weaved into this culture are extremely racist. So if I had a little bit more patience, if I was maybe getting paid to investigate more, I would want to go back to the beginning of Dilbert to now and see all of the maybe even subtle racist or subtle things that were being said that just
or not that so you, subtle that we ignored. Or,
exactly, that are just that people are just eating and consuming, and then it's your and then you turn the page and then you go do it. And to me, those little things, those little crumbs of racism, are just as toxic and just as powerful as the big bold moments of white supremacy. And the fact that he even had captured, even if it's for whatever, to the 2 minutes it takes to read a comic or the minute that it takes to read a comic, even the fact that he had so many people's imagination for that set, those few amount of time, even that shifts a mind, even that reinforces certain types of ideas around domination. It's just sad. It was a show too, right? Dilbert, it was a television show.
And when the television show was canceled, he said he lost his job because he was a white man.
I don't have much to add besides I love it. Shout out to the newspapers for letting them go. And if anything, the scariest part of me for this was like, Twitter is legitimately owned by white supremacists right now. And that is frightening. And yeah, I don't. That's my takeaway from this. Actually, I don't. The Dilbert guy, goodbye. Let it go. I hope that he stays gone and he doesn't get a pseudonym and come up with a new cartoon. Like, I want this man out of here. And then Elon's again the sole person, as you said, that scares me. So maybe you all saw it. Maybe you didn't. Is Ben Stein? Okay, sorry. Okay, maybe you saw it, maybe you didn't, but Ben Stein last week said that he misses the good old days when a, quote, large African-American woman was on a syrup bottle, and that woke corporate culture has ruined everything. And he literally, I'm going to show my wonderful pod folks right now, is he literally has the bottle of Aunt Jemima.
Aunt Jemima. Yummy pancake syrup. Now, this used to show a large African-American woman chef, but because of the inherent racism of America's corporate culture, they decided to make it a white person, or maybe no person at all. But I prefer it when it's a black person showing their incredible skill at making pancakes.
Okay, so Ben Stein literally is like, I missed the days when it showed a black person showing their incredible skills making pancakes. I miss Aunt Jemima, and corporate culture has ruined it for him. So I saw that and was like, Ben Stein, you really came out. I haven't thought about you in a million years. Only had good memories of you. Didn't realize you were racist. And I looked up some stuff about Aunt Jemima. I had no clue Aunt Jemima was not a real person. I did not know that Aunt Jemima was two women. there was one actress who, when she passed away, they replaced her with another actress. And you might have seen the controversy about the second actress's family sort of upset about replacing Aunt Jemima because they were worried about her legacy. But Nancy Green was born in enslavement in 1834, and she became the model for the Aunt Jemima box. And it becomes this image of the mammy. It becomes an image of the like loyal house servant who makes food. And that is what it's meant to be. It's meant to be a comforting symbol of Black people serving white people. There's a piece in NBCnews.com in the Think section, and I'll just read it because she says it better than I could, or the author says it better than I could. The character of Aunt Jemima is an invitation to white people to indulge in a fantasy of enslaved people, and by extension, all of Black America, as submissive, self-effacing, loyal, pacified, and pacifying. It positions Black people as boxed in, prepackaged, and ready to satisfy. It's the problem of all consumption, only laced with racial overtones. So, you know, fascinating is that when Nancy Green dies in 1923, a congressman proposed building a national mammy monument to honor the days of the faithful Negro. She gets replaced by Anna Harrington. That is one of the Aunt Jemimas that a lot of people know, her face. And Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben, as you remember, in 2020, were both removed from the packaging, but both of them were, I just hadn't critically thought about these images. And I really did think that they were people. And I don't know, it was something about being like, these were actresses that really blew my mind. It really did. So I wanted to bring it here.
Yeah, it makes sense to me because I didn't know that because just what I was writing, what I continue and have always wrote about as far as like culture. So it makes sense because the faithful Negro is a fantasy. There was just no such thing. And even, I think I mentioned it here on the podcast before, but the Maya Angelou poem about the laugh and how she talks about how, you know, Black women who are in domestic work, they don't laugh. They part their lips and a sound comes out. So that performance of faithfulness has always been a white fantasy. And anybody who can just think about the contextualization of how this Black person got into your home or you interacting with them, they would have to know that this was performance if they thought critically. The other thing that I thought about when it comes to this is that it's just a bigger idea because I've been hearing so much about woke corporate and woke stuff and the washing of woke stuff and how everything's getting woke and woke and woke is the fact that I do see culture attempting to start from zero. And I think that some people are misinterpreting that as culture making, if that makes sense. Like, us taking out the racist and the sexist and the homophobic stuff and then trying to create something that is maybe heartwarming and comforting that's not on a fat Black woman's back. Like, maybe us creating things that make us feel safe that is not about, gun propaganda. We're only tearing things down in order to start from zero so we can actually create an American culture that doesn't harm anybody, but us being more critical in itself is not culture making. And I feel like a lot of times I hear people say, oh, they took off the Black woman on the syrup bottle, and yeah, so what? And we can think of other ways to make people get that warm, fuzzy Southern feeling without it being misogynoiristic, you know, maybe.
I'll add, I thought it was interesting that you brought this up, particularly now, DeRay. On one of my conservative, very conservative friends' Facebook pages, he just posted this thing about Nancy Green. And it literally, the thing says, a great woman is erased from history by idiots. The branding of the syrup was a tribute to this woman's gifts and talents. Now future generations will not even notice beautiful woman existed. What a shame. The world knew her as Aunt Jemima, but her given name was Nancy Green. Uh-uh, she was an actress. What are you talking about? But this is how people do this thing. They are not celebrating her for her mamminess. They are celebrating her for her She became a wealthy superstar in the advertising world as its first living trademark. It goes on to say she was selected as a spokesperson for a new ready-mix self-rising pancake flour. She became an immediate star. She was a good storyteller. Her personality was warm and appealing, and her showmanship was excellent, right? She was signed to a lifetime contract, traveled on promotional tours, and was extremely well paid. Her financial freedom and stature as a national spokesperson enabled her to become a leading advocate against poverty and in favor of equal rights for all Americans. Like, come on, the whitewashing of even Nancy Green, right? So first of all, like, we glorified the mammy, and now, like, you want to glorify the quote unquote businesswoman? Like, what are you talking about? Like, this furthers the, like, she pulled herself up by her bootstraps and she playing mammy. Like, are you kidding me? And so I just want you to know that this stuff is insidious in, like, multiple ways, right? Like, that even when we call a thing and say not okay to glorify, you know, Black Southern women and use them in this particular way, you want to say, oh, but she was financially independent because you exploited the crap out of her. Are you kidding me? Like, sorry, this is so bizarre.
And Kai, to that point, so they didn't know where Nancy Green's grave was unmarked and unknown until 2015. They reached out to Quaker Oats about whether they would support a monument. And Quaker Oats' response was that Nancy Green and Aunt Jemima were not the same. So no. And that Aunt Jemima was a fictitious character. Like, come on!
But I also don't see, like, why it's so hard to see. Like, you can't see Hattie McDaniel and why she won an Oscar for playing in a mammy. And why it's on the bottle of something that is a product to sell to white people. I think for me, it's just like, I don't, like, how can you not see the connection in that? And in fact, a lot of how casting is still done today is a reflection of that legacy, right? So, Dre, so my grandmother collected Black memorabilia. I collect Black memorabilia. And so one of my prized possessions is the Black Book, which is a collage of all kinds of things, advertisements, photos, archive things that Toni Morrison put together.
I have right? that. I have
Me
that.
Too.
It is. If you have one, treasure it.
Well, I'll also say that Random House exclusively sent me mine. That's my Auntie Kaya flex.
Cause look, flex it, babe. Look, my girlfriend sent me hers. That's love. That's love.
But the importance of this book is the imagery, right? To remind us of how we were portrayed then, how it still connects. And this book came out in like 1974, but all of it is still true to this day, right? So from slavery times all the way through, just in terms of like those racist tropes that are so cemented in American culture and that white people just love. They just love it.
Yeah,
y'all better get over yourselves. And it don't take, it's not, it. First of all, you don't have to be a skilled chef to make a damn pancake. So also that don't make no sense.
I was going to say, to your point as well, like one of the reasons why I stopped writing as much and just, yes, one of the reasons I stopped writing publicly and speaking publicly as much was because if you're not really, you can't really have a conversation about Lizzo, no matter how you feel about her or you don't feel about her or whatever. You can't really have it divorced of context, of Black women, of Black fat women and mammification. Even if, no matter what side you are on, you have to understand that. You have to understand our legacy when it comes to media making and culture making. And that whatever Ben Stein was feeling, that tension that he was feeling that he recorded himself doing is the reason why Lizzo is overly critiqued and seen as disgusting, and also the same reason why Black women are asked to behave in certain ways. Like, all these things are just like interconnected, and if you divorce it from that, you're not really getting to the point, in my opinion.
I had a question of what is the Black, like the actual Black Book?
Oh, it's a book of all of the advertisements, like all of the portrayals of Black people in in all kinds of different things, like in one compilation.
Yeah, so it was made, and it was made in the 70s. So it's really the only place so far where you can kind of see the DNA of like how Black. So everything from like from lynching postcards to cigarette ads are in this, and it's a through line of the evolution and not so much evolution of Black culture.
And essays from Black thinkers interspersed in between.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pods of the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out and make sure you rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week. Pods of the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Evan Sutton. Executive produced by me. And special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.
Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. We're your destination for electrical products. Keep yourself safe and protected with new GFCI outlets from Legrand. They're available in a variety of finishes. Now at Menards, save big on all Legrand outlets and dimmer switches. View our entire selection of Legrand products today on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening this week. Save big.